pray. O Lord, our God, grant that thy law may touch our heart, and that we may also come to recognize its holy reproof. May we also love thy law, meditate therein day and night, that we would acknowledge our complete hopelessness before the reproof and the condemnation of thy law, but if not for the perfect satisfaction that thine own Son has given to thy law, and that obedience which is perfect, which is undefiled and undefilable, that righteousness which is acceptable with thee. And do thou grant unto us that clothed in thy righteousness, we may emulate more and more the perfection of our Redeemer, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, and separate from sinners. In his name, amen.
Now I will deal with the fourth subdivision of our formulation of the doctrine of sin. I just came to it at the close of the hour, namely the all-pervasiveness of God's law. The all-pervasiveness. And the point there is simply this, that the law of God extends to all relations of life. That we are never in any moment, relieved of the obligation which God's law entails for us. Because there is never a moment, never a circumstance in which we are not under obligation to love and serve God. Love and serve God. And if that is true with respect to love, it must also be true with respect to law. Because love and law are correlative, as we found out yesterday. If love is the fulfillment of the law, you never have love. But in relationship to law and in the fulfillment of it. Now this is just saying in another term that we are never amoral or non-moral. We are always either moral or immoral, but never non. Now, it is that principle, the all-inclusive obligation to God, that gives sanctity to all of our subordinate obligations. I say it is this that gives sanctity to all of our subordinate obligations. We do have obligations to our fellow creatures, to our fellow men. Because there are institutions invested with authority
institutions of God's appointment invested with authority. And to them we owe subjection. Within the sphere, we owe subjection within the sphere to which these institutions belong, or the spheres which are defined by these institutions. Now, if these subordinate obligations were not derived of these, there would be a contradiction. Contradiction entering into human life. We owe subjection to our fellow man within these spheres only because they are divine ordinances. And all subordinate is always traceable. It's always traceable. All subordinate obligation is always traceable to a higher divine obligation. Now you might ask, why deal with this in connection with the subject of sin? Why? Now returning to our topic, for this reason, that nothing is sin unless it is first of all a violation of that higher divine obligation. Nothing is sin that it violates that higher divine obligation. This is the truth enunciated in the scripture. There is one lawgiver, one lawgiver. Avoid the ordinances of man. The ordinances of man require us to violate the law of God. And we must obey God rather than man. And therefore, the only criterion of sin is the law of God. We disobey only when the human ordinance is in excess of divine institution and authority. If a human ordinance is a legitimate exercise of God-given authority, then disobedience is sin. Not simply because the act is in violation of the human ordinance, because the human ordinance is in accordance with divine institution. Now that is the plain effect of the teaching of Paul, for example, in Romans 13, 1 through 7. Let every soul be subject to the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. Powers that be are ordained of God. And he that resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God. He goes on, of course, to speak of conscience. You must needs be subject not only for law, but also for conscience sake. Now, conscience, of course, always relates itself to the law of God. God alone is Lord of the conscience. And if we obey out of conscience, it is because we recognize in the human ordinance an exercise of divinely instituted authority. Now it may be sometimes that human institutions impose ordinances that are in excess of their God-given authority. They establish ordinances which are in excess of God-given authority. When these ordinances require us to violate the law of God, then we must, as I said, disobey men and obey God. But if these ordinances of men are in excess of God-given authority, but do not require us to violate the law of God. Do not require us to violate the law of God. Then, of course, obedience is a matter of expedience. It may be inexpedient to disobey. It may be expedient to comply, but we must remember this, that if these ordinances are in excess of divine authority, then we may violate them without sin, when a higher divine obligation requires us to do so. And that is thoroughly germane to our assessment of what sin really is. Sin must be defined as violation of the law of God. That's anomia. Hence, the law by which sin is to be judged is not variable, not thee. Circumstances and conditions will affect the heinousness of violation. Circumstances and conditions do affect the heinousness, the gravity, but circumstances and conditions do not determine what the law of God is. Circumstances and conditions do, of course, determine which aspects of the law of God pertain to us in these circumstances and conditions. I say they determine what is the relevance of the law of God in these situations, but they do not of themselves determine what the law of God is. And that's why you can have in the scripture permanent, invariable principle of divine obligation. And it is these principles enunciated in commandments which are the criteria by which we are to judge sin and sinfulness. Well, I'm going to go along that. Now, we come to the fourth main subdivision that we will do. Yes?
Just have one question. Did I understand correctly here that if he's following a separate kind of authority, that it is not a sin if we violate them?
No. It's not necessarily a sin if we violate them. That is to say, you see, they may be in such a state of God-given authority that the divine law requires us to violate. Requires us to violate. And therefore, if they are in excess of God-given authority, they do not necessarily obligate our conscience. That is the point. Now, there are many laws in existence. Many laws in existence in a state that it is inexpedient to violate, but nevertheless, there are circumstances which arise when it is not only proper, but it is an obligation to violate them, because we have that higher divine obligation involving upon us. And that applies, of course, in many, many situations left. And consequently, I think it's necessary to liberty of conscience and the discharge of our divine obligations to recognize that fact. Sometimes it is necessary out of obedience to God to violate. And that's not simply when the ordinance is expressly in violation of divine commandment, or sometimes it's expressly in violation. And the magistrates, of course, commanded Peter and his associates to desist from preaching the gospel. You remember they said, we must obey God rather than men. the human requisition, the requisition of the magistrates, the sanctuary, in violation of their divine permission. Now, on other occasions, laws on the part of men may not be so blatantly in violation of the law of God, and they may not ordinarily require us to violate the law of God, that is, compliance with them, may not ordinarily require us to violate the law of God, and consequently, it is expedient that we should obey them as Christians, but sometimes we shall have to disobey consciously and deliberately in order to fulfill our highest divine obligation. Now for capital D. No, I said that sin was a real evil, sin was a specific evil, sin was a moral evil, and that is C. Now we come to D. Isn't that correct? You go back and find real evil, specific evil, moral evil. Now, this is not the
matter. You had moral evil as
subject
under sin being
a
specific evil.
That's the way I said it yesterday?
Yes.
Hmm?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Oh, I would have let you have it that way. I didn't mean that. But you could all have it that way if there's no let us adhere to that if it was simple. But I didn't mean that really. I mean, if I did that, I should just on what I meant to do, because that was my real intent. Real evil, specific evil, moral evil. I may have slipped at that point and not put C on the board. But if you have your notes, that's all right. But that was a slip up on my part, and it was my fault. Well, let's make it this way then. Sin involves pollution, blame, and liability. These three parts. Pollution, blame, and liability. Now, if you like Latin, do you like Latin, Mr. Boss? You a Latin hound? You a Latin hound? You come across them in the first season, so you will not read the Latin itself. And there's a great deal of theology involved in these three expressions. Well, in English, it is called pollution, blame, liability. Now, pollution. That, of course, as we found already, refers to the defilement of heart and of mind, the defilement of the disposition of complex, from which all sin proceeds. And it is very important to bear in mind that sin is never a volitional abstraction. Never a volitional abstraction. That is, an act of will abstracted from that which is both determinative in the human personality. That which is most determinative in the human personality is the heart, what the Bible calls the heart. That is that which is most determinative morally and religiously. That which is most determinative in the human personality is the heart, what the Bible calls the heart. That is that which is most determinative morally and religiously is the heart. And what is being emphasized here is the depravity of the heart, apart from which no sin exists. Isolate a simple action from that from which it issues, and it is a pure abstraction that has no reality, that has no existence. Out of the heart are the issues of life. Out of the heart are the issues of death. Well, you can see how important this aspect of youth, defilement, of this clarity, natural. Then, secondly, it involves blame. And that simply means that the person is blameworthy for everything that is in contravention of divine obligation. He is blameworthy for everything that is in contravention of divine obligation. And there you can see how important it is, again, to emphasize that aspect of sin. Because in a great deal of pseudo-Christian ethics, there is the tendency to excuse the person. Perhaps because of ignorance, perhaps because of supposedly ameliorating circumstances and conditions under which the sin was committed. But the point here is that wherever there is sin, wherever there is the contravention of a divine obligation, either by way of omission or commission, either by way of coming short, or by way of over-transgression, there is the blame devolving upon the person whom that sin is predicated. Therefore, you have liability, and that refers to The penalty devolved that accrues to the person because of his blameworthy disposition and action. I prefer to call it the judgment of God, the penal judgment devolving upon the person or accruing to the person because of his contravention of the law of God. The judgment, of course, is inevitable, because sin is the contradiction of God. And that which is a contradiction of God must elicit God's displeasure, indignation, and wrath. And the judgment of God is always epitomized in his wrath. Now here it is necessary to understand the precise course of a term which you always find in theology, beatitia, Latin term. It is a substantive, and the corresponding adjective is wills, that is beatitia. Beatus really means liability. Liability. Sometimes you will find theologians using the expression beatus culpae. Beatus culpae. In distinction from the beatus prima. That is a misuse of the term beatus. Complete misuse of the term beatus. Classic Reformed theology vigorously rejected the distinction between beatus culpae and beatus poenae on the ground that beatus is always something intermediate between culpa and poena, always something intermediate. And this expression quite properly that a reaction is something that arises from culpa and leads to pain. Something that arises from culpa and leads to pain, that is, arises from blame and leads to penalty. So bear that in mind, that in the Reformed theology, reaction is always conceived of as the liability arising from blame or fault. The liability. And therefore, we really speak of reactors, penile. That is the liability to penalty, but not of reactors culpable. No, that's simply to set straight that terminology.
In English, we often use this word gift. Gift. But there is a certain ambiguity attaching to the use of that word gift in our common speech. And also to the adjective guilty. When we say a person is guilty, we mean that he has perpetrated a certain wrong. And we speak of the guilt as synonymous with the sin itself. It is often used to denote the wrong committed. So guilt in common parlance is the synonym of transgression. And we should not interfere with that common parlance, that common usage, because it is common usage that determines the connotation and denotation of a term. But in theology, the word guilty
and also the term guilt
is often used to denote the Latin term reaction. And therefore denoting the liability arising from sin. That is to say, it is often used in theological discussion to denote what in Latin is called obligatio ad finem. Obligatio ad finem. Now, when in theology guilt is used in that restricted sense, bear in mind that that is what it has reference to. It has reference to the obligation to the judgment of God, which accrues to sin. Now, to conclude our discussion of the whole subject of the nature of sin, three observations. It is very important that our thinking, be oriented to these emphases. Comprehended under these three subdivisions, and I meant four subdivisions, but that is what it is not. Because today we may find a great deal of emphasis upon the undesirability, the hatefulness of sin, and even the filthiness of sin. without any truly, truly Christian affection of sin and lawlessness, and as involving pollution, blame, and guilt. Pollution, blame, and guilt. Using gift in the more distinctive sense that I just stated. The biblical estimate of sin is that it is wrong. That it is wrong. Not only undesirable, but damnable. And it is that concept of wrong that enshrines in itself, it is that concept of wrong that enshrines in itself all that has been, all that I have said, respecting sin, the violation of the law of God. And this is also important in our present-day context to lay particular emphasis, upon the judgment which necessarily attaches to sin. That contradiction of God and of his perfection. When sin is conceived of as contradiction of God and of his perfection, then we must appreciate the correlate, namely, that he reacts against with holy displeasure, with indignation, with wrath and condemnation. We are here confronted with a divine impossibility. A divine impossibility. And this divine impossibility is not his weakness, but his strength, not his reproach, but his glory. He cannot deny himself. And therefore, to be complacent towards that which is the contradiction is a divine impossibility. A divine impossibility. That God is holy, that he is justice, that he is truth, and that he is love. And because he is love, he loves himself supremely. And loving himself supremely, he cannot but contradict that which is an assault upon his majesty, dispute with his sovereignty. for his goodness. Contradiction of his veracity.
Well, let's now pass on to the next main subdivision of our discussion of the doctrine of sin. The second main subdivision of our discussion is the doctrine of sin. That is dealt with nature, sin, alienated it under these various subdivisions that we need for definition of what sin is. Now we come to the next main subdivision, and that is the imputation of Adam's sin. The imputation of Adam's sin. This, of course, is concerned with our relationship to the sin of Adam. The imputation of Adam's sin. No, I'm going to be lecturing on this for a week or so, and I will be following the lines of what I have in this little book, The Imputation of Adam's Sin. I won't be bringing in anything really new. You can find everything in there, like I was saying, for the next week or so. But I could just let you read the book, but I do not think that you will get the material as well as you would if I go over the main part, because there is a great deal in that book that I'm not going to deal with, and I'm afraid you would get lost, especially in the latter part of the book. And so I'm going to lecture on this subject in order to abbreviate and somewhat simplify and also drive home the main considerations bearing upon this all-important question. Now, in dealing with this subject, there are two passages in particular in the New Testament that bear upon the question. They are not the only passages, but there are two passages in particular. And these are Romans 5, 12 through 19, and 1 Corinthians 15, 22. They are the pivotal passages. Good deal of the discussion will pertain to the interpretation of Romans 5, 12 through 19. Now, in dealing with that passage, there are five main subdivisions under which I shall assume discussion, and there are subject A, the syntactical construction, the syntax of the passage, the syntactical construction. Then second, the sin contemplated, that's capital B, sin contemplated. The union involved, and B, the nature of the imputation, and then five, and finally, the sin imputed, A, B, C, D, E. The syntactical construction, the sin contemplated, the union involved, the nature of the implication, and the
Now our discussion of this will involve a great deal of historical theology. And that is required because the discussion of this question is one that can only be dealt with adequately if it is oriented to the question of historical theology, the question that emerged in the discussion of this matter in history. Now, I'm there within presently, so I won't fulfill it today.